something outside.
What is that?
Monster X Radio listeners, this is Gunnar Monson, one of your hosts of Monster X Radio and the founder of the Sasquatch Coffee Company. Sasquatch Coffee, have you tried it, Yeti? And if you go to www.squatchcoffee.com, you can pick up some of your own, including our new variety, Feelin' Squatchy. With me today on this very sunny Oregon Father's Day is my good friend and co-host, the Monster X Radio, Shane Hardcore Corson. Mr. Corson, how are you today?
Howdy, Gunner. Doing well on this semi-sunny Washington Day, and happy Father's Day to all the fathers out there. Looking forward to this show, part two, with our special guest, Mark Mercell. I'm really looking forward to this show.
No, I'm always, Mark's, we had the pleasure of going with Mark to the cabin site of the Fred Beck incident and last year, and Mark's just a cool cat. It's funny to see him, like, this big, huge guy go up and down the mountain like a goat. You know, he's 3 points of contact, man, 3 points of contact. I did learn that, so.
Yes, yes.
It was a blast. As if you've heard our, you should go back and listen to the show we did with Mark about the trip to Ape Canyon, because it was a great, fun time chatting with Mark, because he is kind of, I mean, to me, it's like he saved a significant piece of Bigfoot history, because a lot of Bigfooters are aware of the, you know, the Fred Bay incident, the miners that were bombarded by rocks in the cabin. That's the story. And he went back and actually found the site of the cabin. So kudos to Mark. And it was no easy task, as I'm sure, like you said, if you go back and listen to that show and last week's show, you'll hear him tell about the process. So, and
yeah,
Shane,
yeah,
you actually did a presentation up in Washington yesterday. How'd that go?
I did, and actually I covered a little bit about the history of the Ape Canyon, but it went fantastic. I had a good crowd, a very eager crowd that was very interested in the subject, but really had not much knowledge on the subject of Sasquatch, and so it was a privilege speaking before them and letting them in on, you know, what some of the Olympic Project research is and what we've been doing, a little bit about historical reports, the name behind, you know, how Bigfoot came to be, the name of Bigfoot and Sasquatch, and some of the Native American stuff. So it went really well. You know, I did just under an hour presentation, and like I said, I left feeling pretty good about it. The attendees were ecstatic. They a few of them came up to me and said, you know, you might have made me a believer in this Bigfoot. And I said, yeah, that wasn't my goal. My goal was to show you a little bit of what I consider to be some really good and factual stuff on the subject. And so it went well. I'll probably be doing some more of those down the road, and we'll see. I know we're definitely going to talk about Mark Mercell. You know, he's got a couple of speaking engagements coming up, one's in Montana and one's in Kennewick, Washington. We'll definitely discuss that right towards the latter part of today's show. So if folks want to hear more from Mark Mercell, they're going to get a chance at two opportunities in two different places. So, yeah.
And that's really the first opportunity that I got to see Mark was at Hopsquatch, and he was talking, and like, you know, that just fascinates me. I like the history of the subject, and that's, for someone from the Pacific Northwest, that's one of those iconic stories, you know, up there with Bluff Creek, you know, that's one of those that just solidified it as a kid. You're like, wow, there's, you know, that's a cool story. It's scary. So,
And today we're going to get a chance to hear some lesser known but very fascinating, interesting historical stuff in regards to possible Bigfoot attacks and just the history behind it. And I'm really fascinated to hear the process. Mark always has a fascinating process, and he truly is like the Indiana Jones of this, as I said last week, when it comes to these reports. The way he's not just looking at literature and newspaper articles, he's getting out there and rappelling down mountains and hiking and surveying.
No, and it's the funny, I mean, I still go back. If you listen, I had this like image of dropping down this little rope into a meadow at Deep Canyon. And boy, I was in for a surprise when we actually got there, because that was not like that. It was, you know, going down a mountainside into a canyon, an actual canyon, not a divot in the ground. But it was an awesome time. So let's get Mark on here. I'm eager to hear what he's got to say.
Hey, you guys.
Hey,
happy Father's Day. Happy Father's Day, you guys. Both of you guys.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks for joining us today on Monster X.
Oh, please, you guys. I'm so privileged and proud to be on Monster X. I really appreciate you guys having me on to go blathering on and on and on about the projects I'm working on.
Well, I'm a fan because, like, we were talking about with Shane, is like, you know, that this is an iconic 8 Canyon, for one, is very iconic incident, you know, part of the history of Bigfooting, particularly in the Northwest. But
it is, yeah.
And that with the Mount St. Helens eruption, you know, kind of the thought was that that site's probably gone, obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
And you put an incredible amount of time and an effort into finding it and going to it, not just finding it on a map, but going down to the site, so, which is not an easy task. And a lot easier for you, but
no,
but
not,
still,
I'm really proud that even, you know, after a year, you still, you know, both of you have remarks considering that it was a fun trip. So I'm really proud of you guys that you think it was so fun.
No, I still remember coming when we came around the corner and we looked at the where we were going down to. I was like, man, I wonder how I can actually fake a broken leg right now. Just that, you know.
It's that that place where you stand at the top and look down that slope, and I'm up here and that cabin site's down there. That has turned away some other people that I've taken up there. And it's like, oh, I'll just go hiking and I'll meet you back at camp tonight. And then go off and do something else because like, I am not going down there. And so some people haven't. So, you know, you guys made it and you made it back and we were all safe and we had a great time. So,
It was a great time. So, well, Mark, I'm sure that you talked a little bit about it last year, but last week, in case you somebody didn't catch last week's show, can you give us a little bit about your background?
Oh, sure. I was born as a land surveyor. My dad was a land surveyor since he was about 18 or 19, and he joined the Oregon Highway Department and became a surveyor that way. And then shortly before I was born, he ended up licensed and started the family business. And so I grew up as a land surveyor ever since I was like 10 or 11 years old, you know, carrying stakes and chopping brush for the family business. And I ended up getting licensed in Oregon and Washington and then buying the family business from my dad. And let's see, that was in 1995 and just have been running the family business ever since. just a private land surveyor doing all kinds of things, dealing with. It's one of the great joys of the profession, and I've come to realize as I've gotten older, I guess I'm 51 now, is that one day you're dealing with, you know, farmers who have come to shotgun blows over a fence line one day, and then literally the next day you're dealing with suits and ties developing waterfront property. So you have this whole wide range of people that you're dealing with and coming in and just trying to help them solve their problems of whatever their problems are regarding property lines or whatnot. So it's great variety. The other true joy pertinent to what we're talking about today is that in any given survey project or boundary survey, there is a tremendous amount, I think most people don't realize, there's a tremendous amount of document research and field research that goes into any given survey before you make your case, before you drive that iron rod into the ground to say it's a property corner. There can be, sometimes the answers come quickly in the record, in the deed record or the survey record. Sometimes it takes weeks and weeks and weeks to try to sort out what really happened in the past, and using all that information and using the field evidence in order to make your determination. And that's really what Ape Canyon was all about, and that's what Thompson Flat Monster project is all about, is going to every single repository of record document that you can think of. There's a lot of dead ends, but you just think of anything possibly that might be out there and getting a copy and stuffing it into the file and gathering as much evidence as you can. And then taking that evidence out into the field and trying to correlate it with what you can find in the ground, trying to find what is left in the ground to put the whole story together.
Mark, you know, We discussed last week a lot about the Ape Canyon, but I'd like to really get in here and dig on some of your new work when it comes to, I'm not sure which one you've been doing the most work on. I would imagine it's the Flatwood Monster, but let's dig into that, and if you can, give us a little background on the history of that story.
This is a very complicated story, and one thing that I've been wrestling with thinking about today's show is how to try to make sense of it. So everyone has to kind of put on their thinking cap on this one, because there's a lot of information on this one, and it's very complicated. When we talk about this story of the Thompson Flat Monster or the Wild Man of the Sixes, and part of the incident is what I'm calling the Butchertown Murders, as well as the Chetco Indian Devil Massacre, they're all one and the same. It's all the same story. So maybe I'll start with how I got into this project. My wife, Catherine, is truly wonderful in that she comes from a family of librarians, and she's a librarian herself. And any time you might express something to her about something you're doing or something that you're working on, she'll go out and find stuff. You know, even if you may have seen it before, she'll still grab it and say, well, you know, bring it to you and say, well, maybe you haven't seen this before. So she was at the library, and I was hanging out here at the aquarium working, and she brought back this little booklet, and unfortunately I cannot recall the name of it. It was published sometime in the 1990s, and it was a short book, maybe 40 or 50 pages long, along the lines of Field Guide to the Sasquatch. And in the first half, there was field guide information about, you know, what the phenomenon is and what this creature looks like, and footprints and other evidence that's been found. In the back half of the book, there was sort of a minor version of the Bigfoot case book by Board and Coleman, in that it gave a short compendium of historical Sasquatch sightings or encounters. And it covered Oregon and Washington, I believe Northern California, and maybe parts of British Columbia. I'll have to try to track down the name for you guys. I'm kind of embarrassed, because the first thing I always do is, in that kind of book, is immediately go to 1924, and look at the Ape Canyon write-up in those kind of books. to see what they wrote about it and to see what I may agree with or not agree with, you know, on each canyon. So I did that, and then I'm going through the book that night, and I come across this story from 1904, and it rang a couple bells, but not exactly. I thought that I had heard about it before. And the story, the 1904 incident in Thompson Flat involved a gold mining area. It involved men seeing a creature, seeing footprints, taking shots at it, rocks being thrown back, and then the cabin attacked in the middle of the night. And the thing that kind of floored me about it is that the story read just like Ape Canyon, but it wasn't. It was 20 years prior. So Thompson Flat, to give you some geography, Thompson Flat is down in Curry County, Oregon. It's the most southwesterly county in Oregon. It's also one of the youngest counties in Oregon as well. And this area of Thompson Flat is about 10 miles or so east of the coast, east of Port Orford, Oregon. And it's this small flat area on the north side of a branch of the river. It's on the South Fork of the Sixes River. This area is, geologically, you're getting out of our volcanic area here in the Pacific Northwest as you get south, and you're getting into a strong marble uplift. You know, you're getting into the Marble Mountains and the Klamath Mountains area where you're getting outside of the volcanoes. So it's sort of like a mini Rockies where, say, heading from north to south, you'll have very, very steep mountains, like small Rockies. And then Thompson Flat is a small ledge. It's maybe a quarter mile north and south and about half a mile east and west. And then continuing south, then you're immediately on that small gorge at the South Fork of the Sixes River. And there are creeks that feed into that. One of them is a creek called Butcher Gulch. And in 1904, that got me started on this, in March, there was one of the gold mining claims in that area called the Harrison Claim. And a fellow named Ben Harrison Sr. had claimed it. It was a placer mine. They're mining gold. And a family friend named Ward and another friend of his, Burlinson, were working this mine for Ben Harrison Sr. And they had seen this creature in the woods. But frankly, at that point in 1904, it wasn't too much of a surprise to see a large hair-covered hominid going through the woods, because we'll get into this in a second, but the area had a long history, this very limited area had a long history of these creatures being seen in the woods and sometimes very violent encounters. So naturally, the first thing that they do is take shots at it, and it was nearby camp near the mine and where a cabin had been built called the Harrison Cabin. They took shots at it, and the shots either missed or had no effect. Rocks were thrown back. This happened about twice to Ward and Burlinson. And then as they're in this small cabin at night, the cabin is grabbed and shaken violently and beat upon. Well, they stay inside because they're scared to death. About a week later, Ward is back up there again, and he's with Ben Harrison's two sons, Ben Harrison Jr. and Bob Harrison. And they had seen the creature again through the week. And that night, early morning, about 5 o'clock in the morning, the cabin is attacked again and beat upon. Well, they're ready at that point, and they burst out of the door. And there's this large hair-covered creature. In that area, most of the reports say it's about 6 or 7 feet tall. And they take shots at it about 100 feet away, and the creature turns and goes back into the woods. Well, when I got that story, and I ended up getting the original newspaper in the Myrtle Point Enterprise, when the 1904 encounter was published, I read it through, and, you know, naturally I'm coming off of Ape Canyon, and it's like there's a gold mine, and there's a cabin that was attacked by a monster in the woods. Well, maybe there's some evidence of that gold mine left. Maybe there's some evidence of the cabin left. So I started to get very excited about the story, and I'm frankly still very excited about the story. So taking off of that, I started looking into the area and found that there was such a large amount of reported encounters with this creature at Thompson Flat, frankly, in the vicinity of about once a year, dating back to about 1875 through 1904 and continuing on a little bit into the 19-teens. And it was one of those missed opportunities where we didn't have a naturalist or someone doing some sort of natural history research available in the area, because the encounters were so strong and so frequent that it could have been an opportunity to actually identify a species in Southwest Oregon, and we wouldn't be discussing this over Monster X Radio, but instead at some rather boring scientific conference in Connecticut or something like that, you know. But there was a tremendous amount of encounters into the area. When it was reported in the newspapers, it was reported as the Wild Man of the Sixes, and that's why we have the name Wild Man of the Sixes. I'm calling this project the Thompson Flat Monster, which was also used. That term Thompson Flat Monster was also used a little bit, but I'm trying to get away from the work that was done in Northern California a few years ago that they called their project the Wild Man of the Sixes, because it took place in the Sixes National Forest. So, but historically, it's all one and the same, Thompson Flat Monster and the Wild Man of the Sixes. What started, there was one single incident that is the earliest record in this neighborhood of an encounter, and that one incident started two things. It started the Euro-American, if you will, the white fellow's awareness of this Sasquatch-like creature up in the woods, and that same incident also started what is called the Southwest Oregon Gold Rush. Thompson Flat was sort of like the Sutter's Mill of Southwest Oregon, and there was a fellow, I only have his first name right now, it's Tom, and he was a prospector. He was an older fellow. It was in his late 60s or so, and he went up. He told friends leaving town that he was going to go up to Star Mountain. Star Mountain is immediately on the south side of the South Fork of the Sixes River, just south of Thompson Flat. He was going to go up to Star Mountain and do some prospecting. Well, he didn't come back. About 3 or 4 days later, his friends are like, you know, where's Tom? And so they go up looking for him, and they find him unconscious at the bottom of a short drop. And he's still alive. And so they get him, and they pick up some of his items that are nearby his person, and they nurse him back to health. They get him back into town. While he's getting better, his friend looks in his pack, and he finds this incredibly large piece of quartz. And on the end of the piece of quartz, there's this large nugget of gold, largest ones that he's ever seen. Tom comes too. And he explains what happened, that he was picking and just processing with a hand pick in the ground. And all of a sudden, he's grabbed from behind. And it was such split-second timing, he really didn't get a good look at what grabbed him. But it was something large that was able to grab a human up off of the ground. And he was throttled and beaten and thrown down off of a short drop of about 20 feet or so, knocking him unconscious. All that Tom was able to say was that it was incredibly large and incredibly strong and covered entirely with hair. And so once Tom gets back to health, by that point it's getting into later in the season around fall. Miraculously, Tom goes back up there a little bit better armed, but doesn't have any more encounters. That was what started our awareness of the creature in the woods. But once Tom and his gold got out, Thompson Flat ended up being a sizable place for many people to come in around Thompson Flat and to start their gold mining prospects. And at first, there were maybe about two or three lode mines, hard rock mining. But after a while, they realized it was more profitable and easier to get gold just by placer operations. So up in the small area of Thompson Flat, there's dozens and dozens of claims in this very small area of placer locations. Shortly after that, I'm not sure if it was the same claim or not, but it's a famed story that showed up in John Green's book. A couple of fellows, Robinson and Benson, had filed a claim. One of them was called the Wild Man Claim. Another one, for history buffs, was the Bigfoot Claim in the early 1880s. I think that's the true origin, the first time that the word Bigfoot was ever used, you know, not to discredit any of the Jerry Crew incident, but that's the first indication I found of the word Bigfoot. But they were working their claim up there. They were returning to camp up a ledge, and there's a creature there at their camp, and they described it as 6 or 7 feet tall. One thing interesting that keeps being repeated in all these stories is that it's covered entirely with yellow hair or yellow fur. The creature is there, and the creature is just tearing apart the camp, just trashing everything like a college frat party or biker gang fun. They're just tearing everything apart. He's tearing everything apart and throwing it down. The two men have their rifles with them and take shots at it, and the shots aren't doing anything. So prudently, they turn around and they run back to town and sell their claim shortly after that. Well, by that point, there were a large number of people getting very, very interested in the gold in that area. And time again, stories would end up into this area of seeing these large creatures in the woods. Sometimes eyewitness encounters, sometimes just large tracks in the mud in a creek bed. Sometimes two sets of tracks were found. There was a fellow named Dr. Elgin who was working in the area, and he came across a creature described exactly like Benson and Robinson did, of 6 or 7 feet tall and with yellow fur. And the creature is at the creek bed. He stumbles across him, and the creature is aggressive and growls and yells at him and bares its teeth. Elgin comes back and he gives the story, and it's published in the paper. I've never counted it up, but I would estimate in this period there was about 30 to 40 encounters published in a variety of newspapers. And that's one thing that's kind of important to this story right now, is that Curry County was one of the youngest counties, and what are the first two industries that you can think of that enters into a place with new money, a place that has a lot of money? And one of them is, of course, banks, and the other one is our newspapers, that even though this was an extremely rural area, there was logging, there was mining, there was a lot of money coming in there. And in this small area of Curry County, Coos County to the north, there were about 3 or 4 papers that were being published regularly in that area, right, on a weekly basis. There was just a vast amount of information being published about the goings-on down in that area. So one thing that I remember 2 years ago talking to a friend about this. One thing that I had in my mind about the whole Thompson Flat incident, and I was telling a friend about this and talking to him about Thompson Flat, that I recall in talking with this friend, I recall that I had come across a story that around the 1880s, 1890s, that I had heard that or read somewhere that I had gotten that it was not that uncommon, perhaps you could call it uncommon, but it wasn't that unusual for a miner in that area to go missing and then to be found dead later with his head crushed and or his body throttled to a pulp. He was dead, right? So I had that in my mind. And this is one of the things I learned on this project, that any, you know, when you get a research project and you're getting this avalanche of information on top of you, it's, you get so excited about all this kind of stuff. You have to remember that when you come across a piece of information, copy it and stick it in the file. Because I was telling my friend about this, and I kind of run my life on kind of delayed gratification, that sometimes, you know, a package will come in the mail and I know what's in the package and I'll stick it up on a shelf and I'll just wait for the right, I know what's in the package, I'll just wait for the right time and just savor it. So with the story of these deaths, I kind of put that aside and I was waiting for the right time to really get into the meat of these murders, of these deaths, of these men up there. And so the time comes, okay, I'm ready to go. Let's really get into this. And so I start looking through the file, and I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm looking through the file, and it's like, where is that? I couldn't find anywhere where I got that information. I looked, so, you know, it's kind of a mistake, but I looked all over the Internet and tried to find where I got these story of these deaths up at Thompson Flat. Well, I couldn't find it. So it's like, well, I was thinking, well, maybe I'm getting confused with another story, which is the Chetco Indian Devil Massacre. And the Chetco River is about 60 miles south of Thompson Flat. So I looked at the Chetco Indian Devil story. Now, the Chetco Indian Devil story, and I'll give it to you briefly here in a second. This was collected by Ivan Sanderson, and Ivan Sanderson is a well-known figure in the cryptozoology world and in the Sasquatch world. The guy was from Edinburgh, Shane, one of your fellows, and he came to America, and he was a botanist, and he traveled the world collecting information on plant life, on animal life. And he was involved with botanical surveys in the United States and would start picking up these weird stories because, you know, you do a botanical survey out in the woods or out in the extremely rural areas. You don't do it out, you know, you don't do it out in the middle of a city. So he'd come across people who would tell him these fantastical stories of this large Sasquatch kind of character in the woods, and so he started getting very interested in it and started publishing some information about it. Well, he had gotten a story about a fellow, a civil engineer in Crescent City, California in the late 1950s, and so he went to visit this fellow, and the fellow told him the story of a massacre of people up on the Chetco River by this large hair-covered creature in the woods. So this story was published in True Magazine. Sanderson published it. It was later retold by a very well-known writer named Marion Place, and she was a well-known young adult writer, and she wrote a book called On the Track of Bigfoot, where she wasn't a Sasquatch researcher, but she collected these Bigfoot stories. She lived in the Pacific Northwest. And she retold the Chetco Indian Devil story. And then later, and more recently, Will Jevning republished or transcribed Marion Place's story of Chetco. So that very, very briefly about the Chetco Devil Massacre is that this took place on the Chetco River in southern Oregon. And it was either 1890 or 1898. And it was either a mining camp or a logging camp. So that discrepancy in years and the discrepancy between a mining camp or a logging camp, that's kind of where the story stops diverging, and it keeps getting retold the same time after that. But there's a large mining camp on the Chetco, and there's a large amount of people working there in sort of a small tent city. And some of the miners, who are men predominantly, have their families with them. So they have some of their wives with them, and including some of their kids. And they start having, at night, they have these strange encounters of strange screaming and yelling in the woods. And they're kind of getting a little unnerved about it. Some of the younger guys, a couple of the younger men, children, come across tracks in a nearby creek. I believe the story holds that they may have had a sighting. Well, with all this kind of buildup, the miners and the people in the camp start to get very concerned. And they decide that we need a round-the-clock, 24-hour watch, armed guards. We're all going to take shifts. Well, one night, this screaming from the woods, this yowling, animal-like sound from the woods, erupts, and everyone's out of their tents, everyone's grabbing their guns, and we're going to go into the woods. And so the men go into the woods armed, and they realize partway through, going through the woods, trying to track down the sound, they said, wait a minute, nobody's back at camp to guard the camp. And so half of them split off, and they go back to the camp. And no sooner had they gotten there than this animal, like screaming, is still going on in the woods, but now it's being accompanied by human screaming and gunshots going off. So holy smokes, they charge back into the woods. They get to the point where the party had broken up, and they can follow the brush line and continue on in. And by the time they get to a certain point, the human screaming has stopped and everything is quiet. The gunshots have stopped. And they find the rest of their companions ripped limb from limb. They're all dead. Right? And so that's the Chetko Devil story. Well, when I started re-looking, trying to track down where the heck I came across these dead miners up at Thompson Flat, I started to look into the Chetko, you know, starting with Ivan Sanderson's story. So I looked, and again, that's why I pointed out the fact that there were three or four regularly published newspapers in the area, and the newspaper accounts were silent. There was nothing to back up Sanderson's story that he got from that civil engineer in Crescent City. I couldn't find any record of any large mining camp up the Chetko. The Chetko massacre was supposed to take place about 6 or 7 miles upriver from Gold Beach, the next major town south. I just couldn't find anything at all on the Chetko. And so I put it to bed, and I was thinking, well, you know, this whole murder, death story, I don't know where I got it. Maybe it was a dream. Well, there's a point in historical research when you have to go to that location where the records are kept. And for me in Southwest Washington with Thompson Flat, those areas are down in Southwest Oregon at the courthouse or the Historical Society or whatnot. So you kind of get stalled sometimes, and you're back home, you're trying to make gas and groceries, and so you're stalled waiting for your time to be able to go down and put in the time to do the document research. Well, when that happens, I like to read the newspaper, but I like to read the newspapers from like 120 years ago, and I'm just kind of poking around, looking at the newspapers and just seeing what's interesting. And I'm always shocked at the strange times when you're just perusing the paper or perusing some sort of historical record, you know, whatever, logging record, mining record, deed records, and just by some sort of strange happenstance, you come across something that is not only related but highly pertinent to what you're researching. So I was stalled for a few weeks, and I was just looking through the paper, and I came across an article in the Coast News, which was the paper out of Coos Bay. The town was called Marshfield, and in the Coast News there was a reporter who said, this is an article from 1879, and he said he had other business in the area, but had heard about this camp up on the South Fork of the Sixes River. And he went up there and wrote an article about it. And at that point in 1879, mind you, this is just about 5 or 6 years after Tom was attacked up on Star Mountain, he said there was a sizable camp at the mouth of Butcher Gulch as it fed into the South Fork of the Sixes River. And they had called it Butchertown. And they said there were about 40 people there, some living in tents, some living in cabins, and they were mining. And some men had their wives with them. And he interviewed a lot of these people. These folks were working their individual placer mines, and then they would come together at night and sort of live communally. You know, they would share dinner together and trade goods and you know, they were living. He said they were living relatively peacefully and communally in this area. So this is ringing any bells, you know, all of a sudden that there's this large mining camp, you know, at Thompson Flat and not at the Chetco. So after a lot of poking around, I finally found this article, and now I recognized it all of a sudden, that was published in the 1930s. And it was published in the 1930s in the Myrtle Point Herald, I believe, and it was published by Bob Harrison, one of the teenage boys that was in the cabin at the Harrison cabin in 1904. He had gone on to become the editor of the newspaper, and he was the editor of the newspaper for a long time. And he wrote extensively because his dad was an early pioneer and his dad was an early mining guy. Bob Harrison wrote extensively on early Southwest Oregon mining history and early pioneer history. And Bob Harrison was the key for me, that what happened up at Butchertown was that at one point, mind you, I want to go back to this 1879 article where the reporter reported on the camp at Butchertown, and when he did that, he actually named names. He named Dr. Elgin, who later had that encounter with a yellow-haired creature at the stream. He named another fellow named Ramsey, who went by the handle Ramrod Ramsey. He interviewed another fellow named Mike Madigan. He actually named these people. Well, in Harrison's article in the 1930s, he related that at some point, everyone's back at camp one night. This is around 1884, around 1885, and they're having dinner, and a couple of guys say, you know, where's John? There's a miner, a friend of theirs, John Jensen, and where's John? He's not back yet, and he should be back. So they go to his cabin, and they knock and open the door, and John's not there. Well, we'd better go check. We'd better go up to his claim and take a look. And they go up there, and there's John, and he's dead. His head's been crushed. His head's been bashed in. And next to him is a bloodied rock, maybe the murder weapon. Well, about 4 or 5 weeks later, this happens again with another fellow named McClone. And they find him, and his body's completely battered, right? A third miner, whose last name was Johnson, and his first name was Thomas. I don't know, sometime, for some reason, in the late 19th century, he had to have a nickname. Was known originally as Bullhide Johnson. Later, he got to be known as Coarse Gold Johnson once he found a gold mining claim. Well, Johnson goes missing. When Johnson is missing, Mike Madigan has an encounter. Mike Madigan had his own claim in the area, but he was mainly kind of known as the camp huntsman. He went out with his two dogs and hunted and brought meat back and traded it for goods. Mike is out hunting with his two dogs, and they come up on this rise. And again, there's this large hair-covered creature, covered in yellow fur, and one of his dogs takes off. The creature grabs him, grabs the dog, and starts throttling him. And Madigan starts shooting at the creature to no avail. The other dog takes off, and Madigan tries to call him back. Come on, come on. And the dog's not coming back. By the time the creature throws down the first dead dog and Madigan's shooting, the creature grabs the second dog, and Mike takes off, and both of his dogs are dead. Shortly, about 2 or 3 weeks after this incident, they find Johnson's body, and it's entirely bashed to death, and Johnson's dead. It wasn't too long after that when the camp is cleared out. Everyone's scared. You know, everyone's terrified, and nobody's up there except Madigan himself, still living in his cabin up at Butchertown. Well, he comes back to town about once a week or so to get supplies and trade and that kind of thing back to Port Orford. And one period, he doesn't come back. And his friend Ramsey again, Ramrod Ramsey, he goes up there and he starts looking for him over the period of weeks. At one point near Thompson Flat, he finds this pile of stones, this pile of rocks that seem to be piled there unnaturally. And he starts pulling it apart, and in there, sure enough, there's a dead body, a dead human body. And he recognized it as Madigan from the knife on his belt and from his revolver, which was still in his holster, right? And so that was the story that Harrison gave us, and it's a fascinating story, right? But the one thing that is disturbing about the whole thing is that this area of Thompson Flat is now, and maybe it was then, in the Rogue River National Forest. And just off the edge, still in the National Forest, just off the edge of Thompson Flat, there's a small burial plot, tiny little burial plot, small cemetery, and it's called Huckleberry Knoll. And all of the grave markers are indistinguishable, and they're all rotted out, and there's this old sign, Huckleberry Knoll. But the Genealogy Society in Curry County has record of 4 burials in Huckleberry Knoll off of Thompson Flat, and all 4 names of the burial record match the 4 names that were told in the story of the men who were killed at Thompson Flat.
Wow. Right.
So I think there's something to this story. Part of that, too, you know, until more record or more evidence comes out, I am strongly suspecting that the famed Chetco Devil Massacre that was collected by Sanderson, I don't think it happened. I think the Chetco Devil Massacre actually got confused with Thompson Flat. So right now this is sort of where I was in Ape Canyon about 8 years ago. This project is really in its infancy right now. And unfortunately, even though it's in its infancy, the file is about 2 inches thick right now of all the paper goods. So there's lots more to do. There's lots more to do. There's death records, sheriff's records, medical examiner's records to see if there was any kind of exam done on these bodies and some sort of record left behind. I have the deed records and the mining records to go through, ultimately to try to find the Harrison cabin. So there's lots more to do. And, of course, I'm planning a field trip this summer down to Thompson Flat. The main one for this trip is I'm going to be spending about a solid week or so in the vaults trying to go through all the records. But because it's so close to town, I can't go down there and not visit Thompson Flat, just to walk down there. You know, I mean, not to necessarily to collect any field evidence or look, but just to go down there and see where all this took place, because it's somewhat sort of accessible. I say that now, you know, like we talked about East Canyon, but it's only about 10 miles in from the coast. And so right now, at least I say it should be an easy day trip, at least just to go down and have lunch for an hour and then come on back. So that's where I'm at with Thompson Flat.
No, Mark, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in regards to the Thompson Flat monster, didn't a few people describe what they saw as like the devil? And could that be some of the confusion with the Chetco devil scenario? Could that be maybe some of the confusion there, just to using the word devil?
That could very well be. Devil for sure. Wild man is certainly one of them as well.
Mm-hmm.
There was something strange. I mean, one thing that was terribly interesting culturally. I'm not a social psychologist at all, but I find it interesting that there were so many reports coming out of Thompson Flat. I feel, in a way, that it was one of the rare times when Euro-American culture, white folk culture, started to take on an understanding of this creature in the woods, much like you see in Native culture, in Native American culture, where with, you know, perhaps if you're able to know or speak with someone who lives on one of the nations and who's a tribal member and who's kind of hip on Sasquatch, oftentimes the phenomenon is treated as there are these people that live up in the hills, they live up in the forest, and they live up there, and you don't mess with them. You know, when you go up into the mountains, you only go so far, and you don't go into their area, and then you come back, and everyone can live together peacefully. The people in Port Orford, I feel, were starting to get that way with how many reports were coming out of the mountains. As an example, in the early part of the century, in the 1900s, maybe into the 1890s, the local high school, the local public school's sports team name was the Wild Man. The school would have carnivals during, you know, some carnival night, and you can go to the carnival and play games, and you could go to the fortune teller and have your fortune told, and you could also see, you could, you know, a dime or a nickel, that you could go behind the curtain and actually see the Wild Man in a cage, you know, at these school carnivals. It was like the football quarterback dressed up in bearskins, of course, but that was like an event that was published to see the Wild Man at the school carnivals, you know. So that's probably part of the confusion of these names being bantered about. One other incident that I think provided maybe some confusion is there really was a massacre at Chetco, but this took place in the 1850s or 1860s at the mouth of the Chetco at Gold Beach, and it was an early guy who was just frankly an evil man named Smith, a white pioneer who instigated a massacre of the old native village at the mouth of the Chetco, and he went in and he killed many, many people and tried to burn out their houses. So there was that massacre, so that maybe has something to do with the confusion about the Chetco Devil Massacre. The other thing, too, is that we live with that story of the Chetco Devil Massacre, but frankly, it's only coming from one source. It's only coming from that civil engineer that Sanderson interviewed. And I just couldn't find any corroborating document or evidence or anything like that that the Chetco Devil Massacre actually happened.
Okay. And with the four graves, these four individuals, the names matching, on these grave, on the headstones and whatnot, would there be a date on them, do you think? Or is
well,
there a
normally
date?
Normally there would be. I do have photos that were taken by a hiker through that area of the Huckleberry Knoll Cemetery. And he took these photos just because it was a day hike. I believe it was a geocaching fellow who was really into geocaching, and that was one of his goals, is to go out and find the Huckleberry Knoll Cemetery. So I do have a few photos from him of the photos that he took, and as best I can tell is that this a lot of the gravestones were made out of cedar, right? And so cedar can last a very, very long time. But from the one distinguishable headstone grave marker in the area, you can see writing on it, but in the photo you really can't tell what it is. So the point is that, you know, it's ground truth. I got to get down there myself and find the ground truth and actually look at this myself. But I do find it terribly interesting that the Genealogy Society has the burial records of the four names matching the story of the Butchertown murders.
That's it. That's, I mean, what an amazing possible piece of the puzzle, amazing find. I find it fascinating, too. Keep using the word huckleberry. That, to me, is very interesting all by itself because of the amount of, you know, being involved in this research, the amount of reports that Sasquatch is seen in and around huckleberry or in areas of huckleberry. Every time I hear you say that, yeah.
You bet. I mean, I know that you guys know, and I know you guys have been there, but that area around, quote-unquote, the Dark Divide, you know, on between Adams and St. Helens, holy smokes, you know, there's just a ton of huckleberries out there, right? You know, and so that's a lot of the time where we get a lot of the reports coming out of that area as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Mark, having done the Ape Canyon, and you're, I know it's a never-ending it's never-ending research. There's still more. Yeah, I mean, it's continuing on and on and on. But now getting involved in, you know, some of this other ventures, you know, like the Thompson Flat and thing you've got going on right now. Which one's a little more difficult? Are they about the same? Is there are you finding that one was easier than the other, or one what you know?
Frankly, Thompson Flat is turning into a much more difficult project, and let me explain it that Ape Canyon basically only took place over the period of about 2 years for those miners between 1922 and 1924, where they had laid claim to the Vendorwhite mine on Mount St. Helens in 1922 and spent the first couple of years tent camping up there and then built their cabin in 1924, and the cabin was attacked and they were out of there, you know. So it was basically over the period of 2 years. And the cast of characters was maybe limited to less than a dozen. Thompson Flat is running from Tom on Star Mountain in 1875 for the next 25, 30, 35 years. Mind you, it's still a limited area, but there's 35 years worth of encounters, 30 years worth of encounters up there to sort through and to sort through all of these people. And there's like, I don't know, there's like two or three dozen people involved in the story up there who had some sort of encounters. So Thompson Flat is one of those things where it's going to take a while, frankly, in order to sort everything out. I'm finally getting around to the point now where I'm writing down in sort of a book form everything about Ape Canyon, but I have no idea when I'm going to get to that point for Thompson Flat because it's a massive project. It's very, very big. But it's one of those things that's fun because you can do the document research at the same time that you do the field research, and so it kind of like drives you, keeps the inertia going to go out there and spend some time up there. One difficult part too, that's the difference between as far as the field research goes,
right,
between Ape Canyon and Thompson Flat, is that up at Ape Canyon, you know, you're up at the timberline, and you might come across another hiker going on the trail. Or you might come across some marmots or some, you know, goats or nightbirds. But down at Thompson Flat, that's solid bear country. You know, that's very, very intensive bear country. And that can always make things more exciting as far as visiting the area goes.
I have my bear, my grizzly experience, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah,
Mark,
yeah, bear repellent is definitely in order on this one.
Yeah. Mark, when you go down to this southern Oregon area, what specifically are you going to be looking for in doing? And have you found any contacts yet that you can reach out to? You know, I know with the Ape Canyon stuff, there were certain people you could reach out to, and you could actually get a hold of. Are you finding the same sort of scenario with your latest adventure?
Yeah, you bet. I haven't contacted them personally yet, but I've tracked down the grandchildren of Bob Harrison, who are still in the area. Once Bob Harrison went to Myrtle Point and became a newspaper editor, he was a newspaper man in town for years and years and years, and so he became a relatively prominent family. So I've been able to track down some leads on some of his relatives. Because there are two things, there's one or two things. I would like to contact them to see if Harrison left behind any stories, which I'm thinking that he did. But there was a story published in 1902 where I believe it was one of the Harrison family involved, where the headline said, "Wild Man of the Sixes" or "Wild Man of the Curry County Now Dead." And the story was that somebody bagged this large creature, same thing, 6 or 7 feet tall, shot it, and had it up in his cabin up there at Thompson Flat, and was in the process of deboning it to rearticulate its skeleton. So I know it's a pretty wild story, but, you have to ask the question, did your grandfather leave any, a box of bones floating around the attic or something like that, So there's that. And then also, I can't stress enough that when you get a research lead where you have a lead for some information or you have a lead for a story or some sort of resource, you absolutely have to track it down. In that, Curry County was one of the youngest counties, right? And so at the time in the 1880s, and so they did not have a lot of resources rolling in yet as far as establishing a county and establishing different departments or members of that county, like the sheriff or a medical examiner or a county surveyor or whatever. So I was in contact with the state archives, Oregon State Archives. And it's one of those things where you have to find the right archivist to speak with who has that little piece of inside knowledge, because I contacted Oregon State Archives to see if they had any death records, any, early perhaps sheriff's records or medical examiner's records about these four men. And no, they don't. And on the state level, death records only go back to 1908. And he said, no, you have to go to the individual county, right, to where in the county auditor's office or the county clerk's office where that information is held. And he said, as an aside, which was gold, he said, Curry County probably doesn't have any medical examiner's records or sheriff's records. But I told him I was looking into a premature death case down in Curry County, Oregon. And he told me, a lot of the time he did have knowledge that in the case of murders or something unusual, he said you needed to check with Coos County to the north, because in something that was kind of out of their league or that they didn't have resources for, Curry County would go to Coos County and contract to them for help. So, I'm going to be dealing with Curry County, but I'm also going to deal with Coos County as well to get into their records on the off chance that the Coos County Sheriff or the Coos County Medical Examiner got involved on this. So, yeah, lots of contacts to track down there on this one.
Wow. Mark, you're a pretty amazing guy. You rock. I'm so excited about this. I'm so excited about this work you're doing, and I've been fortunate to be a little bit a part of it, but this is I love stuff like this. You are doing some amazing stuff, and if anybody out there is interested in Sasquatch or Bigfoot or anything like that, you gotta listen to Mark here, because the historical stuff, I mean, it's truly amazing stuff. I mean, and it's fun to look at history and find fact from fiction or fiction from fact and all the little hidden things that the little gold nuggets to be found out there that you're doing something special. I don't think this sort of stuff's not cut out for everybody. You really have to have patience, a keen eye, and gusto. I mean, and you got all that.
Just tenacity. Someone tells me, no, you can't do that. And it's like, oh, really? I can give it a shot. I can try it. Maybe I'll fall flat and nothing will happen. But, you know, at least I want to give it a shot, you know. And so that's one thing about the conferences coming up, which I've been very, very nicely invited to. By the time that those conferences come up at the International Bigfoot Conference and Big Sky in Montana, by that point I'll have at least a field trip down to Thompson Flat, and probably some photos and videos, and I'll have gathered hopefully some more information about these four guys who were killed and a lot more information about the mining history. So I'm hoping to present a lot more information on Thompson Flat by the time I get down there.
Well, fantastic stuff, fantastic. I mean, and once again, you know, the conferences, you're doing the Big Sky Conference in Montana. And
yep.
Can you give us the dates on those again? I know the International Bigfoot Conference is September 1st through 3rd, I believe. Labor Day weekend, right. What about the Big Sky Conference?
You know, I don't know. But
okay.
It's about 2 weeks after that.
Yeah.
Let's see here. I am looking it up. I believe it's September 22nd and 23rd in Hamilton, Montana. And that's a good lineup too. They have a lot of fun speakers at Big Sky as well.
Oh yeah, I know Dr. Jeff Meldrum will be there, you know, anthropologist from Idaho State University. Amongst other great speakers, Tom Broadhead and some of those guys. And then, of course, you know, the National Bigfoot Conference is going to have an amazing lineup as well.
Yeah, you bet. So, yeah, Sarah Throckmorton, who runs the Big Sky, was very nice to invite me to that one. So I'm looking forward to Montana. I haven't spent a lot of time out in Montana, so that'll be a fun one. It's going to be a busy September because I'll just be coming down off the high of International Bigfoot Conference, then I'll be going out to Montana for that. That'll be fun.
Well, Mark, I want to thank you for coming in, and I can listen to you for hours. This could be, you know, we need to do this again and again, updated when you, as you progress with this project. I just can't thank you enough for the effort that you put into, like, research. You're talking hundreds of hours to at least hundreds of hours. I'm sure you're up to thousands, over 1,000 hours in the Ape Canyon project already. But
Just ask Catherine on that one.
And I want to thank your wife for being such a patient.
Let her know. Thank you, guys.
So, but holler at me if when you're headed down there. I'd love to join you if I'm available. So that'd
be
cool.
I'll let you guys know because you know you guys did Ape Canyon and if you haven't quit on me yet, that was the time to do it. So I'll let you guys know. No, it'd be a fun trip for sure. I'm really excited about it.
The key is that it's called Thompson Flats, so that's good for me.
And Gunner's good
flat.
Bear base. Great bear base.
Flat.
So.
Yeah, flat is relative.
Yeah.
You get there. No, from what I understand, it's marble uplift. Here up here, northwest Oregon, southwest Washington, you have nice rolling volcanic features. With that one, from where I'm expecting to park the car, it's about a 2 mile trip in to Thompson Flat. And the best I can tell is it's about half a mile of gain. You're going downhill the first time, but then you got to go back home. So it's steep and brushy and wooded. It's steep, but it's flat when you get there, if that helps at all. So.
Okay, well, Mark, thank you for joining us today and as well as last weekend. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and talk with us. I listened to you for hours, so.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, I tend to go on and on. But, no, thanks so much. Monster X has always been a big supporter, and I really appreciate you taking the time to listen to my project. So thanks, you guys.
All right. Well,
thank you, Mark.
Shane Corson and Mark Marcel and myself, Gunnar Monson, we want to thank you for listening to Monster X this weekend, and have a great week. We'll be back next weekend with another new, brand new Monster X Radio. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Radio.